You guys know I'm crazy about Audible because it offers an incredible selection of audiobooks across every genre. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, including the latest bestsellers and new releases. Audible really is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment, with female writers and heroines, celebrity narration, multicast productions with immersive sound design, and traditional audiobooks. Audible has you covered for any type of excitement that you're looking for. In fact, right now I'm listening to The Second Husband by Kate White. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/realitylife or text realitylife to 500-500. That's audible.com/realitylife or text realitylife to 500-500. With four daughters and two on a dance team, I can tell you we go through a lot of mascara in my house. But I'm crazy about L'Oreal Paris new Panorama Mascara, which catches every lash from corner to corner for maximum volume. If you're looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank, this is yours. The new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look in a premium gold luxe packaging. I've been using it for about 2 weeks now, and I feel like my eye has completely opened up, and the girls are crazy about it too. They've got a tapered brush to catch every lash, one of the best mascara wands that I've ever used. And like I said, this luxe appearance of this gold package, you got to get it. You can buy Panorama Mascara on Amazon today. L'Oreal Paris new Panorama Mascara, you're going to love it. Welcome back to another episode of Reality Life with Kate Casey. Listen, American politics are a real shit show. Tyra Banks, costume designer on Dancing with the Stars, basically puts her in outfits that can only be described as Halloween Moulin Rouge. Real Housewives of Potomac's major plot points include an assault and a husband who was caught in a compromising situation with somebody in a hotel room while his wife was on a girls trip filmed for the show along with her newborn. One of the stars of 90 Day Fiancé is a man who lives with his mother, and his ex-wife is basically getting free plastic surgery procedures in exchange for camera time. So I've been immersing myself in true crime documentaries and docuseries because somehow that feels more uplifting. And I know that you guys agree with me. In fact, I noticed this week that three of the most captivating cases covered in 2020 on my show involve men responsible for murdering their families. This term's called family annihilation, or sometimes called familicide, and it's defined as one family member who murders other members of their family, commonly taking the lives of all. It is most often to describe cases where a parent, usually the father, kills his wife and children, and then sometimes himself. And often, there is no outward signs visible to suggest anybody was in danger or that there was a risk of an individual taking such horrific actions. So the first you will remember was part of the Netflix series Unsolved Mysteries, and there was the case of the French family where the father murdered all of the members of the family. Xavier Dupont-Ligonnès had been missing since 2011 after the bodies of his wife and four children were found buried in the garden of their Nantes home. And the co-creator of the series has said, "There have been sightings of him all over the world, which has proved to be difficult because his plain features basically make him indistinguishable from any average man. There have been sightings of him at a gym in Argentina, a local market in Switzerland, even recently in Chicago." So people are just fascinated by that case. In Wilderness of Error, Jeffrey McDonald murdered his pregnant wife and two daughters. 48 years later, Chris Watts' case mirrored the McDonald case. Both mothers were pregnant with their first son. And the question is, what would make someone do such a horrific thing? I explored the McDonald case last week with the Wilderness of Error director and Bob Duffy, one of the first MPs on the scene of the crime. And in this episode, I interviewed Jenny Popewell, director of American Murder, The Family Next Door, which is on Netflix. This documents the events leading up to a disturbing 2018 triple homicide of Shanann Watts, who was 15 weeks pregnant with their son, Nico, and her two young daughters. Told via archival footage, this true crime documentary unfurls through home videos, social media posts, police body cam recordings, news reports, and private text messages. So Jenny takes you behind the scenes, exploring the incident from husband Chris Watts' suspicious behavior to his extramarital affair and family disagreements. So the background is that Shanann and her two daughters, Bella and Celeste, were reported missing on August 13th, 2018 in Frederick, Colorado. The following day, Chris spoke with the local media outlets from his home and pled for the safe return of his wife and children. By August 15th, so 2 days later, he had failed a polygraph test and subsequently admitted to murdering her in a fit of rage after she allegedly killed Bella and Celeste. American Murder details the couple's chaotic relationship in the 6 weeks leading up to the murders and builds to the revelation that Chris actually smothered his daughters to death after murdering his wife at the family home. The bodies were eventually discovered at Chris's place of work, and he is now serving his life sentence without the possibility of parole at the maximum security facility, Dodge Correctional Institution. So, if you're unfamiliar with the case, this is the timeline just before my interview with Jenny, the director, just for reference. So, May of 2018, Shanann surprises Chris with her third pregnancy. She regularly posted videos about her family on social media. So, when she found out she was pregnant for the third time, she made a video. So, in the clip, Shanann surprises her husband by wearing a t-shirt that says, "Oops, we did it again," and then films his reaction. They're already parents to 4-year-old Bella and 3-year-old Celeste, and the couple were planning to name their son Nico Lee Watts. In June of 2018, Chris starts having an affair with Nicole Kessinger, so just 1 month later. As reported by Insider, his mistress Nicole Kessinger told authorities that she had started seeing the married man more seriously toward the end of June. Kessinger met Watts at his place of business, Anadarko Petroleum, where they both worked at the time. So according to Kessinger, Chris claimed that he was separated from his wife and in the process of getting a divorce. However, entered into the discovery document, the Frederick Police Department detailed Google searches made by Kessinger during the time period. For instance, she searched, "Man I'm having an affair with says he will leave his wife," on July 24th, suggesting that she knew Chris was still married when she started seeing him. In an interview that she gave to the Denver Post, it was later revealed, one day in the middle of June, he walked into her office and introduced himself. They continued casual conversations, and she noticed that he did not wear a wedding ring. So June 27, 2018, Shanann takes her daughters to North Carolina. They traveled for 5 weeks for a vacation. Chris was set to join them toward the end of the trip. In July of 2018, Shanann becomes suspicious. So during the vacation, Shanann starts to question Chris's behavior as she felt he had become more distant. So in text messages shared by the Weld County DA via Insider on July 10th, Shanann told Chris, "I miss you and I feel like you just want to work out and run." In reality, he had been reportedly been on multiple dates with Kessinger while his wife was away, including spending Independence Day with her at that family home. So according to Frederick Police Department's timeline in their discovery document, Chris joined his wife and children in North Carolina on July 31st. Around a week prior, on July 25th, Chris searched Google for when to say I love you for the first time in a new relationship, suggesting that his relationship with Kessinger had been progressing quickly. And on July 28th, Kessinger and Chris took an overnight trip to the Great Sand Dunes National Park together. In August of 2018, August 4th, Shanann sends Chris an angry message about his family. So as detailed in American Murder, the family next door, she becomes very angry with Chris's mom and dad when they ignored her daughter Celeste's peanut allergy. As a result, Shanann sent Chris a long message explaining why she stood up to his parents. And according to Insider, Watts later told investigators that he believes he may have killed his wife and kids due to pent-up anger that he harbored toward Shanann for what he described as driving a wedge between him and his family, feelings he said dated back to the beginning of the relationship. Also on August 4th, Shanann noticed that Chris no longer had a picture of her as his phone background. Instead, he'd replaced it with a picture of the sand dunes he'd visited with Kessinger per the official discovery document. So August 7th and 9th, Shanann tells friends about her marital problems. So she starts to open up to her friends about the trouble she'd been experiencing with them. She canceled her baby's gender reveal party after feeling as though he was not excited about having another child. In text messages shared by the Weld County DA, Shanann told one friend, "I grabbed his hand during ultrasound and he didn't grab back." In another series of messages, she wrote, "Chris said we are not compatible anymore. Said he thought another baby would fix his feelings." She also mused, "One only thing I can think of, even though I don't think he has it in him, is another girl." August 9th through 13th, Shanann goes on a business trip to Arizona. While his wife was away in Arizona, Chris left the girls with a babysitter and took Kessinger on a date to the Lazy Dog Sports Bar and Grill in Erie, Colorado. Shanann seemed to be suspicious of her husband's evening out after noticing a charge for $60 on their shared card. Per the Frederick Police Department, on August 11th, Shanann searched Lazy Dog menu, presumably trying to figure out whether Chris had been at the restaurant with another person. On August 13th, 2018, Shanann and her daughters go missing. She was due to fly home on August 12th, but her flight was delayed. As a result, she didn't arrive home until August 13th at around 1:48 a.m. She was dropped home by Nicole Atkinson, who was the first person to raise the alarm when she couldn't get a hold of her best friend later that day. Shanann, who was 15 weeks pregnant, was due for a doctor's appointment for which she never showed up. Per People, a police officer arrives to conduct a welfare check on Shanann at around 1:40 p.m. and was met by Atkinson at the residence. So that was her best friend. So Chris, her husband, subsequently arrives home and lets the officer search the property. Shanann's purse, phone, and medication were all in the house, but there was no sign of her or the couple's daughters. Chris told the police that Shanann had planned to take the girls to visit a friend, although he had no further details about his wife's whereabouts. In a scene in the documentary, a neighbor suggested that Chris was acting strangely regarding the disappearance. Chris was captured on camera leaving the house around 5:27 a.m. that morning, claiming that he was heading to work. So August 14th, 2018, Chris pleads for Shanann to return home. In a series of television interviews, Chris insists that Shanann had left the house on her own accord. Speaking to a local TV station, he said, "I just want everybody to come home." But when quizzed by a reporter about whether they'd been in a marital fight prior to Shanann's disappearance, Chris replies, "It wasn't like an argument. We had an emotional conversation. I'll leave it at that. But I just want them back. I just want them to come back." On Denver 7, Chris said, "Shanann, Bella, Celeste, if you're out there, just come back. If somebody has her, just please bring her back. I need to see everybody. I need to see everybody again. This house is not complete without anybody here." Well, the next day, on the 15th, Chris fails a polygraph and his affair is discovered. According to Frederick Police Department's discovery report, the regional manager from Chris's place of employment contacted the police to reveal that they'd been aware of a relationship between two of their employees, Watts and Kessinger. Later that morning, Kessinger contacted police to discuss the case after reportedly becoming concerned by news reports regarding Chris's missing wife and children. As seen in American Murder, The Family Next Door, and detailed in the Frederick Police Department's discovery report, Chris underwent a polygraph test on August 15, which he failed. Afterward, he confesses to murdering Shanann, initially claiming, however, that she killed their daughters and he retaliated by killing her. Following the arrest, Shanann's family released a statement to the news media. "It is with deep hurt, confusion, and anger to confirm our beautiful cousin Shanann Watts, her unborn child, and her two angelic daughters, Bella Celeste, were viciously murdered by husband Chris Watts, who confessed the killings. Please keep Shanann's parents and brother in your prayers." After his arrest, Shanann's body was located at the Andarco oil field, one of the locations where Chris worked. Shanann had been strangled at home by her husband and moved to the site. The next day, after locating Shanann's bodies and removing it from its burial site, two more bodies were removed from oil tanks nearby. They were later identified as the daughters who were smothered by their father at the site. On August 20th, Chris was charged. He was charged with 3 counts of first-degree murder, 2 counts of first-degree murder for causing the death of a person under the age of 12 while being in a position of trust, 1 count of unlawful termination of a pregnancy, and 3 counts of tampering with a deceased body. On November 6, 2018, he pled guilty to the murders. Despite his previous claim that Shanann killed their daughters, he pled guilty to 9 criminal counts, including murder, the unlawful termination of a pregnancy, and tampering with a dead body in exchange for an agreement that prosecutors would not pursue a death penalty. In November of 2018, Nicole gives her only interview about the affair. Speaking to the Denver Post, she said of her affair with Chris, "We had just met. I barely knew him." Kessinger also claimed, "When I read the news, I found out he was still married and his wife was 15 weeks pregnant." He was sentenced to 5 life sentences with no possibility of parole. As noted by the outlet, Judge Marcello Kopkow told Chris, I could objectively say this is perhaps the most inhumane and vicious crime that I've handled out of the thousands of cases that I've seen. Nothing less than a maximum sentence would be appropriate. According to an October 2020 report, so this month, Nicole could potentially be in the witness protection program. Her current whereabouts are unknown, and her Google searches before and after the tragedy reveal that she was concerned about how her affair would affect her reputation. 2 days before Chris was charged with murder, she Googled, "Did people hate Amber Fry?" a reference to the mistress of convicted murderer Scott Peterson. She spoke to the Denver Post in November 2018 and has not been heard from since. So, this is the background of the case. I was beyond thrilled to get the chance to speak with Jenny, the director, about her film. This is, by the way, her directorial debut. I know that if you've watched it already, you will agree with me that this is spellbinding. If you have not watched it yet, I encourage you to maybe press pause, watch it, and then come back and listen to the rest. Because at first is going to have my interview with Jenny. And then afterwards, I asked my friend Kate Kennedy from Be There in 5 podcast to help me unpack the film and talk about the various reasons this case is so compelling, including the way their lives played out on social media. I'm really excited for this episode. I hope that you will jump in the Facebook group afterwards, Reality Life with Kate Casey, and talk about your thoughts about the film, about Jenny's directorial debut, and how you felt about the case afterwards. So, here we go. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Kate. Hello.
How was this project developed?
So I saw the crime. I read about it in a British paper, but I wasn't looking at it as a filmmaker. I was just a parent reading about this absolutely tragic case. And straight away, when the article said that she had an open Facebook page, I went to her page and had a look at her videos and just fell in love with Bella and Cece, and Shanann seemed so relatable, and just it stuck with me and I kept thinking about her. And then in February, they released his confession and it exonerated her fully. And at that point, I thought, I've never seen this amount of media captured around a story. And I decided that this would be the opportunity to tell a story without any interviews or voiceover, because why do you need to bring someone in to tell you what happened when I can piece it together and you can see it with your own eyes?
That's really what's most interesting. It consists only of archival footage. There's this mountain of video footage, massive 2,000-page case file, huge amount of media coverage. How were you able to get access to so much footage, and especially the police videos?
That's actually part of freedom of information and part of Weld County's transparency. Anyone can get hold of that footage, and many people on the line have. You know, YouTubers for years have been putting those videos out. They're all uploading them in digestible ways. Some people are editing them together to create what happened that day. Some people are focusing in on one moment and looking to solve the crime or figuring out, hold on, who's this person? So anyone can get hold of this footage, but I wanted it to be from the victim's perspective. So actually it was more important that we had as much material of Shanann as possible beyond what she presented in social media. So although I've put it within social media and the graphics, not all of those videos existed on her Facebook page. Some of them were actually private videos, but it was a way to package it and go through the material in a digestible way that you understood it.
So how big of a team do you have working with you to just comb through all this footage?
Yeah, it's a relatively small team. I've got the most incredible editor working alongside me, and his name is Simon Barker, and he's just a legend. He has made so many incredible feature documentaries. This is my first feature documentary. And wow. We had an amazing archive producer, an amazing archive researcher, Sarah Powell and James Hunt. And they processed it. And then Rick Crosley, our assistant editor, he was able to create algorithms and tables and databases that we never lost any of the material. And wow. Obviously, James was mining news footage. He was contacting all the news stations. And we didn't just have the headlines. When he was contacting his news stations, he was asking for their archive beyond what they put out in the headlines. So that drive is actually, you know, that the drive from the house to the oil site, that was a news station.
Wow.
There's a lot of material that they had recorded on the street on the day, interviewing neighbours, that may or may not have appeared in local news. And yeah, we were able to put it all together and create this.
How much cooperation did Shanann and Chris's family provide? You know, outside of the footage that we see, were they excited to have her tell her story through those videos? Or I'm assuming it was probably pretty painful as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, before I even start, I presented the concept to them and said that I wanted to facilitate Shanann's story by letting Shanann speak for herself. And would they allow me to see any more videos? That no one had asked them, firstly, before they made a film. Everyone makes a film and then tells them afterwards when it's going to air. So that was even a first for them. They said that Lifetime movie, made the film, and then told them afterwards that they'd, you know, made an actress.
Wow.
On their daughter, and apparently they knew her very well, so they were able to create that. So they just hadn't been treated with a lot of respect, I don't think, in the past. And I went out there and spent 5 days with them, myself, Hayley, our line producer, and James, the archive producer. And they told us a lot of stories about Shanann from her life. Her brother had brilliant stories about how she took him to prom. they looked out for him. They're very close, brother and sister. And they just had lots. She treated her parents to a cruise. Whenever she had money, she was, you know, whenever she was doing well, she'd always treat her family. And she was just a really good, well-natured, kind person. And I felt that the internet was tearing her apart and didn't know any of this. So wherever possible, I was looking for moments in there to represent her. So I was interviewing her family and her brother and her closest network of friends to just find out about her, but not just all her, you know, amazing traits, and of which she had many, but what were her insecurities? What does she want to improve about herself? So just that she became this completely relatable, rounded person in the film, and not just a thin, you know, representation of who Shanann was.
Right. Like, she was such this one-dimensional person in terms of the media, that she was this controlling woman who worked as part of this MLM. But then you watch your film and you see this three-dimensional woman who is seemingly having the same sort of struggles that every kind of mom has, and trying desperately to keep her marriage together. Could you talk a little bit more about the dynamic between Shanann and Chris's family?
I've only got to go. I haven't spoken to that side of the family. So all of this is not speculation, but it's, you know, from sources, but it's not corroborated. So I only know that they didn't get along. There was periods where they did get along, and then there was periods where there was fallings out. I think, you know, it's nobody's fault. There was a clash of personalities, and it seemed that they never got along. They didn't attend the wedding. I don't know why. And I can see in the letter that Shanann wrote that she was the person who helped Chris get that relationship back. She said that hurt him. In other text messages, she talked about how it hurt him that the parents hadn't come to the wedding. He talks about that in his police interview as well, that, you know, he's reminded that, you know, he's happy on the day, and they're reminded that they're missing. And I think that is actually so relatable to so many people. You marry your partner and you don't necessarily marry the extended family, but they are now part of your family. And when you have children, or when there's big decisions to be made, like they moved states, they moved 4 states away, 4 hours away. And I think when those sort of moments happen, those life choices, and your partner comes in, it can cause ripples in families. And so many people have divided families. So none of it meant that anybody deserved to be murdered, or any of it led to murder. It was just Shanann's experience. This was her life story. So it was a woman who'd been divorced, and it was a woman who built a mansion at 25. It was a woman who had relatable fallings out with her in-laws, but each time tried to make sure they were in the life. She's got text messages to friends that weren't included as well, about how she wanted Bella and Cece to have both sets of grandparents. She did spend a period of time with them in North Carolina because she did want that. She wanted the families to get along. You know, she could have just stayed with her parents and visited them. But when there's another falling out, was the falling out anything major? You know, it wasn't good. But I don't necessarily think it was just about that one incident. I think it was, you know, for both sides, it was it was cumulative. So it was heartbreak for both of them. You know, nobody wants to fall out with your family.
Did it, at any point, you think about pursuing an interview with Chris, or were you just reliant on the archival footage to just tell the story?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's not Chris's story, so I never wanted to interview Chris. And Chris isn't a credible source. So Chris was proven to lie for 5 weeks and then multiple times. So I don't think he could tell the truth now if I went and asked him what happened. I don't think he knows what happened. His story changes every few months. I'm sure over the next three decades, I'm sure we'll hear different versions of that day. But if we stop listening, then we've removed that power. It's not his story to tell. It's Shanann's life story. We know that she didn't deserve to die. And we know that he should have just got a divorce. So that's where the story ends.
Does law enforcement have any idea of what they believe the sequence of events truly was versus his version?
Yeah.
Like when she came home to, you know, the point that the bodies were taken to the location they were ultimately found, what was the law enforcement's sequence of events?
They know that at some point between 2 and 5, he murdered her at the house. They can tell because she doesn't walk out on CCTV. She's loaded into the car. So we know that she died in the house, and they have examined the footage and they know that the girls walked out the house. And then obviously they know where they were found at the job site. His car has a GPS on it, so they know every time he stops and starts and his whole journey and how long it took. So he's there on CCTV, he's on his neighbor's CCTV, and then his GPS is tracked, and you know when he arrives, and then they know when he left, and they know when his colleagues arrived. So they were able to piece together the time. So they know that Shanann died in the house, and they could see from the neighbor's CCTV that the girls walked out.
And does anybody have reason to believe that when they were put into the oil barrel that they may have been alive at that point, or do they believe that they were smothered perhaps in the car?
Yeah, that's out there. It matches with, which are absolutely devastating, reads the autopsy reports. It's likely that they died from smothering and not drowning.
Okay. Is there any diagnosis for Chris in terms of mental illness? Did he have a history of mental illness? Is there reason to believe he may have committed other crimes?
I don't think he's ever committed another crime, but he's never been diagnosed. He's not spoken to a professional that I know of. From this, he needs to speak to a professional. Obviously, there would be that's the person we should be analysing. You know, when we try to work out what happened, they need to investigate him, not for public consumption, for book sales, and for him to be celebrated and created into some kind of celebrity. But so experts can understand what goes on. You know, the family annihilators are studied, and they've been studied for decades, and it's very, very hard to predict when it's going to happen. But after it's happened, the signs are all there. So it's often connected to family breakdown, and when the family is going to break apart, even if they're the ones that cause it to break apart. This is what happens.
So Shanann's friend Nicole and the neighbor seem to be real heroes in the story. How has the case and the media aftermath impacted both of those people?
Yeah, it's destroyed them emotionally. They are. It's, you know, that Nicole was so close to Shanann, and we've spoken, and I don't want to speak for her, but I know this, she's devastated, and I know it, she thinks about her all the time, and they were so close, and obviously she was so part of that story. She was there for those days. She was in the house. She's the person who raised the alarm. She's so close to that and couldn't believe that that was the outcome. And I think I don't think she'll ever get over it. And I think Nate also, it's traumatic. It's a traumatic experience, and I imagine they've all got, you know, some PTSD after that, never mind the fact that they knew them. You know, they knew them as neighbours, they were friendly, they spoke to them. But I think, yeah, Nicole, I think, is really struggling, and understandably so. And I think the main thing is I've heard from all the friends is that trolls continue to reach, that their job involves them having a Facebook page. Like Shanann, they're in the same job. But people insist. I mean, the film is the film, and what happened is there, but it's such a shame to know that people are reaching out to them and asking them questions all the time, every day. People, I mean, this has been happening for 2 years in their life, but also then passing judgment on them and telling them, maybe you shouldn't have an open Facebook profile page. If you didn't want to talk about it, why don't you shut your Facebook down? You know, people are very judgy again of them. And I just think it's a real shame. And I think people should leave them alone.
I also kept thinking about the friend, the text messages with her friend about intimate details about their sex life and how she's doing, because she seemed to be privy to a side of Shanann and had knowledge about their marriage that others did not have. And whether or not she felt guilt in some, whether it's valid or not, some sort of guilt that she was privy to information that could have helped protect her. I'm just wondering how she's doing.
I think all of them are destroyed by this. Christina is actually Shanann's oldest friend. She knew her the longest. So those are heartfelt messages to one friend. She doesn't feel guilty for this happening. I think she wishes she could have protected her. But she's just destroyed by it. And those text messages were already part of the police discovery. So again, people had seen them and dissected them and interpreted in them, not necessarily in the right way, and looked for the worst in these text messages. They saw pushy and annoying and naggy and all these things that are only levied against women. Mm-hmm. Whereas I saw a woman who is heartbroken and is pregnant and trying to desperately fix her marriage for her children and for herself and for her unborn child.
Tell me a little bit about the mistress. How culpable was she? We know that she had some interesting Google searches. She'd been to the house twice. I've heard that she's in some sort of witness protection program. Is any of that true?
I mean, I never spoke to the police about her. I don't know that she's in a witness protection. I don't think anybody. I think these are all kind of rumors online because she's disappeared. But I think she's capable of an affair, you know, and nobody puts on their checklist a future partner baby killer. If she's searching, as we know, wedding dresses, she's looking for a man that's the full and complete package. And that's what she's been telling her friends. She thinks he's the complete package. The complete package is not a monster who kills his children. So she's culpable of an affair. She potentially knew they were still married. Maybe she believed him when he said that they are separate. She's, you know, he's telling everybody that they're discussing a separation. Maybe she did believe that. Maybe she didn't. I don't know. You know, that it's speculation, and I feel I can't comment on that. But only one person is guilty of killing their entire family, and that's Chris. And she was his motivation, sure. But is she guilty of causing him to do it? No.
And then what do you think was the real, from all of this research that you've done and the time that you've spent with the people involved, was there one event that really seemed to push him over the edge? Was it the moment where she told him that she was expecting another baby?
At that time, he wasn't having an affair. He knew Nicole and he'd seen her, but there was flirtation at work. From what I can tell, they weren't meeting up outside of work and they weren't having a sexual relationship at that point. He was definitely flirting and interested in a woman at work. I think he was surprised and shocked that they're pregnant again because it happened so quickly and they'd had fertility issues in the past. But I feel potentially it is the pregnancy that is a trigger, but I think it's because Shanann was planning a gender reveal, and that gender reveal was happening that week. He just found out it was a baby boy. And if Shanann on her public Facebook put out that she's having a boy, everybody at Anadarko would have been approaching him and saying, congratulations, man, on your son. This is amazing. In front of the woman he was saying that he was leaving his wife for. So I think he suspected that this release of public information could have been the end of his relationship with Nikki. So I don't know. There's a multitude of reasons why he was in his mind. Something had to change and he had to do something. Time was running out. And I think the gender reveal was probably a big deal.
That's so crazy. And it has been said that he has told people, again, he's not the most reliable person, but that the night before when he put the kids to bed, that he knew that was the last time that they would be put to bed. So we have reason to believe this was premeditated, of course, but do we have any information on how far in advance it was planned?
I mean, like exactly as you said, he's not credible. So we can't take it from him. He's never going to tell us the answer. We can only look at research, and research shows when these family annihilations occur, the men are doing it not just hours before, but weeks, you know, days. Wow. And weeks, not hours before. So there's a case in the UK, you know, they go and buy the gasoline, they'll go buy the guns, they'll put things in order that it's all ready and it's a plan, and then it happens. So I do not know. It's, you know, only Chris knows. Will Chris tell anyone the truth? No, I think it will die with him, that secret. But I don't believe Shanann caused him to snap by telling him you can't see the kids again. That's a very, a convenient narrative for him to, again, avoid responsibility for his own actions.
So my last question is about the aftermath of the film and the responses that you're getting. Are you surprised that they're... are still people that that find some faults in a murdered mother?
Mm-hmm. No, it's completely cliche that that we want to blame a female victim for their own murder. That it happens all the time. Women are always blamed for being a victim. If whether you're trafficked, whether you're raped, whether you haven't left your abusive partner in time, why do you keep going back? Why did you have so much to drink? Why was your skirt so short? How did you bring on an attack? And it's a massive problem with society, and we're not going to change that with this film. I just like to highlight that it's happening, and it's happening to her when, as evident, laid out in the film, she did nothing but love her family and love him and tried desperately to fix it. He was the one breaking it and lying, and yet still we're questioning whether she's done something wrong.
Is there anything else that you wish that you had included in retrospect? Anything additional that you want us to know?
No, I don't. There's little nuggets of archive that could have gone in the film, but it was about pacing, and obviously Simon's incredible, our editor, and James Marsh, our exec, are incredible with helping us with pacing and realizing what was important, and you know, it's making sure you focus on the story and not distract people with additional "isn't this nice" and "oh, have a look at this." You know, you have to stick firm to the story. So. Yeah, there is a nice little video that I think is revealing of their relationship that was in the film for a long time, but in the end, just kind of got in the way of that momentum that we wanted to get to the end and hear from Shanann again. But there's a video where they're both sat in her wedding, and they're holding a paddle up, and it's called the Mr. and Mrs. game, and the DJ asks them who kissed who first. And they both put up their paddle, and Chris kissed Shanann first, which makes sense. It's the description that Shanann has said, you know, she pushed him away, she wasn't interested, he pursued her, which makes sense. She's a divorcee, she was completely broken, and she didn't want another relationship, and this guy's suggesting that he's the one. But then the next question was, who said "I love you" first? And I was sure that was going to be Chris, but they put the paddle up and it was Shanann. And I thought that, you know, that summed her up. She wore her emotions on her heart on her sleeve. She was an open book. If she knew, she would tell her friends, she would tell her husband, she would tell people how she was feeling. And that was the epitome of her and his failing. He didn't tell anyone how he was feeling. He didn't understand his own emotions. This is a man who had to Google, "how do I know I'm in love?" So wow. I just think that's that video for me summed up their relationship, that she told him first that she loved him because she put herself out there, made herself vulnerable.
So let's just give one last round of credit to your team. Simon Barker, your editor, James Marsh, executive producer. You've done a spectacular job. Thank you so much for giving voice to this family, this mother and her three children. And I hope that you and your team know that they've done something, you know, really special and really important.
Oh, thank you. That's great. Yeah, they are a really special team.
Thank you so much, Jenny.
Thanks, Kate.
Kate, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So I roped you into watching this. You have said true crime is not something that you invest much time in. Did I suck you into the American murder vortex?
I thought it was really, really interesting in how it was done. I can't wait to hear your interview with the director, because it was such the archival footage in lieu of any other talking heads, narration, et cetera, was a really interesting approach that kind of reminded me of like the Amy Winehouse documentary. It was a little too real.
And I kind of thought in retrospect that there were a couple reasons why I think that this story resonated with so many people. One, it's a case of familicide, a man killing his whole family off. I think it is enormously confusing for so many people and for good reason. And I realized that there are so many cases of it in the most popular docuseries or documentaries of the year. Like there was one in the Unsolved Mysteries Netflix series about a man in France who had killed all of his children and his wife. And that was a big episode. And then you have Jeffrey McDonald from A Wilderness of Error, which is a 5-part docuseries on FX. And I had just interviewed the director, and it's basically the same case, but 48 years apart. And I think, so that is part of it. It's that such an unusual, there's an oversaturation of true crime cases. And these cases of family annihilation are so strange and different, that that's part of it. I also think the way that she was so open on Facebook, this brings in the social media element. And then the third part, I think, is the aspect of the cheating, like having a mistress. Combine that with a very beautiful family with these young children. I think it's hitting all these notes, and that's why the series is number one on Netflix right now. So I was wondering what you thought about that and also the social media element of this case.
Yeah, it's interesting to tie the type of crime together, as those are the most popular programs this year. I did see the Unsolved Mysteries one, and that guy's definitely still on the run.
Totally.
And I think that whenever there's a story, whether it's an anecdotal story of your friend's divorce or it's a documentary, and the narrative is, I was blindsided, they were normal, I had no idea, you would have never seen it coming, blah, blah, blah. There's this uneasiness that washes over you that's like, well, if that's true, we're all just walking in a world not really knowing anybody we think we know.
Yeah.
After he first started to try to say she killed the children and then backtracked, I'm like, now your word is, it's worthless. Like, A, it's like, it's already so awful. But then for him to try to implicate her from the grave when he's the real criminal, like, I was just so furious. And I just believe it was like chilling to watch him try to like lie and act his way through those interrogations. And I just think that like, what was done was done, and he was going to be screwed. And if he didn't like change the story so many times, I just wish he has nothing more to lose. I kind of just wish he would be more straightforward and say exactly how it went down, because I still feel very confused by the whole thing. And I kind of left the documentary being like, am I missing something? He just went from 0 to 60 murder. Like, there's nothing else there. But then I kind of was also like, I guess that's the point. Is that there is, it's the average everyday next door family. It's not some crazy, you know, should have seen this coming case.
So family annihilators are overwhelmingly not known to criminal justice or mental health services. For all intents and purposes, they were loving husbands and good fathers, often holding down high profile jobs and seen publicly as being very, very successful. There are 4 types of family annihilators. The first is the self-righteous killer who holds the mother responsible for the breakdown of the family and will often call her before to explain what he is about to do. The second is the disappointed killer who believes their family has let them down and the killing could be sparked by something like children not choosing to follow religious customs, so like honor killings that you hear about. The third is anomic killers, which is when they see the family as a symbol of their own economic success, but if they suffer some kind of economic failure, bankruptcy, for example, the family no longer serves this function. So that's probably the man in France that killed his family. The paranoid killers are often motivated by a desire to protect their family from a perceived threat, such as having children taken away by social services. So they think that Chris Watts was under the category of the self-righteous killer holding the mother responsible for the breakdown of the family and will often call her before to explain what he is about to do. And they think it's because of the last part of calling before to explain what he's about to do. So 3 days before, while she was at that conference out of town, Chris Watts sent her a photo, and you can Google it. It's a photo of a Barbie, and she's on the couch, and the Barbie has a headrest behind and her feet up and just covered by a white sheet. So it looks like
what?
The Barbie doll is dead. And he sent it to her with no caption, and she wrote back, I don't know how to take this. I don't know how to what this means. And there's reason to believe that he had been planning this for some time. He even said in jailhouse tapes that he knew the last night that he put the kids to bed, that as he was tucking them in, he was thinking to himself, this is the last night that you're going to be alive. So I ran into a friend who is a therapist this weekend and asked him about family annihilators. And he said that most family annihilators do fall into that self-righteous or anomic category, and that the self-righteous ones were often histrionic and dramatic and choosing significant dates, such as like a Father's Day, to commit their crimes. He chose right around the day of, like, he started to plot it in conjunction to her plans to do a gender reveal, because he didn't want her to put that out on Facebook. And the director says the same in the interview that I did, that he didn't want her to announce that they were having a son. So it's like wrapped up in that.
Wow.
And so the friend that I ran into said that for Chris Watts, there is an element of tabula rasa, which is this theory that individuals are born without built-in mental content, and that therefore all knowledge comes from experience or perception. And it's like this clean slate kind of feeling. Like, Chris Watts wanted a clean slate. He was totally obsessed with this woman, and his wife and those kids prevented some block, but the baby, the new baby, created an even bigger block, because not only was she having another child with him, which would make it seem like he wasn't going to have the divorce that he told his mistress that he was going to have, but also that she was going to be having a boy. And there's an element, he said, of, it's called perseveration, which is this pathological persistent repetition in a brain, where he became so obsessed with this mistress that he thought of nothing about her. And the overwhelming negative feelings about his wife over the time became more and more prevalent. So it took over. And so that you lose sense of like your moral compass, because you're so angry. And that's where the plans for family annihilation came into play. But they do say it's these four categories, and that they're confusing, because most people are like, this came out of nowhere. It was a lovely family. He was successful. But there are little underlying things. And I think what's scary for people is like, well, does that mean it could happen to anybody? And you just don't know. Some of the conversations that he has in the jailhouse interviews with the detectives about his family raises an issue of like, did something happen earlier? Because he had a very odd relationship with his parents. And this one author that had come to visit him in jail had said that he would never look at her in the eye. And at one point she asked him, why can't you look me in the eye? And he said, I can't look anybody in the eye. I'm just like that. So there seems to be some sort of issue with him. But the scary part, as I said, with the family annihilation is like, it could be triggered by one of those things. And you just don't see it coming.
Yeah, I think for me, and this is why I can't, like, I need to connect to things like empathetically in some way. And I just so don't connect with these people, because the logic of it, it's illogical behavior that you can't rationalize. But I think when I'm sitting there, I'm like, dude, what is your end game? Like, you honestly think that this is going to get you a new life?
And he really did. Hard to, yeah.
But believe that. But when you bring up like, yeah, even the concept of perseverating in terms of it being like an unpreventable loop of information that is like so distracting to the person, that's an interesting piece of it. I hadn't, you assume something's going on mental health wise, but like true clinical obsessions are just like so different from like things that we call obsessions, right?
Well, then I posted this question in my Insta story yesterday. The baby's name was to be Nico. And some have suggested that it was a family name, but I can't help but think about the fact that not only was her best friend's name Nicole, but his mistress' name was Nicole. So was he somehow encouraging her to have the name Nico? Because she told some friends right before she was murdered that she had planned to name the baby Nico. It doesn't seem like it goes with the other names. And even that video where he walks in and she has the shirt on that's announcing the baby, you can tell that there's something off.
I rewatched that this morning and it was chilling. Watching him be like, that's awesome. And like fake a smile and give her like a half-assed one-arm hug. Like, I there's something so dark to me about that scenario where, especially they kind of made it seem like Shanann was driving this, like she wanted the family and the kids and wanted to portray this certain life on social media. This, she was probably living her dream. And like, then your spouse is living their own personal nightmare. Like that to me is so dark. And I see so many examples of when people, I don't know, whether you pressure someone to get married or pressure anybody to do anything and kind of try to fit them into your own dream. And then the other person resents the other person so deeply.
So true.
And I just, that's kind of what I saw watching this footage. I'm like, he resents her so deeply. Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, she's not doing anything wrong. Like well, at least this documentary too. I love that they told her story and made her seem like they never showed her raising her voice, never spoke ill of her. Like she was just living her best life on social media. And that was to your point about that topic, I guess I would need to hear what the director says, but like, was the point to kind of show Shanann through the lens of how people on social media saw her and not to tell her background story a little deeper? Because they could have gone into the parents and this, like, you know, the kind of accusations of her seeming controlling or whatever, which I hate that people peg onto women. But, you know, dishy shows typically do that to paint a very specific picture of both the victim and the killer, but there was just very little personality profiling here. And it was almost shown at a distance as if I was watching from social media and not watching an in-depth documentary.
Well, what's interesting is she says at the end, you know, this is another case where the victim is the woman and she's made out to be the, you know, she caused her own death, which is insane. Like no insane. One deserves to be smothered, to be murdered, certainly while pregnant. No one deserves that. Like, the commentary, because she had been part of this MLM and had been, people said aggressive with her sales technique, which they are encouraged to apparently do a lot of videos to talk about the product, how it affects their lives. Like, look, I'm somebody who has a great life. I'm doing well. Look at me. That she was part of the problem. Like, if she had not been posting that much, he wouldn't have felt the pressure. The poor husband. Poor guy. And she's murdered, but somehow she's a nag. But the truth was, she was a very successful woman. She happened to be a divorcee, but she had purchased her own home that I believe she built herself at 25. Like, she designed it. And then he is the one that pursued the relationship. But his family never liked her. They looked at her like this divorcee. She was problematic, probably... it was a little bit emasculating that she was someone who was so good at sales. There are women that are writing him in prison. And even though he has admitted to the crimes, insist that he's not guilty and have said nothing but horrible things about this woman online because she had the audacity to post videos of her family, that she was the problem. And I it's really so odd.
It is odd. And it's funny because, yeah, you know, people kind of want to be like, okay, so I want to find out more about the victim that would explain the killer's motive. Like, it's almost like people try to reason it through the person being awful enough to kill and not realizing that's completely irrelevant.
Totally. Yes, exactly.
And whereas the commentary for Chris Watts, that I get so annoyed, it's like, he seems like a great dad, a loving father. I'm like, okay, being a great dad and loving father is the absolute bare minimum. Like, if you have a picture of your kids in your wallet, like, good for you, you're not doing enough. Like,
yes.
People want to praise men so much that do the bare minimum. And we didn't really see him doing anything other than just like taking photos and like playing with his kids, which I hope people do.
That's right.
Kind of funny how people almost want him. Want to use very little footage of to act like he was this great dad and very, you know, footage of her to act like she was super controlling when it should be the reverse and we should be supporting the victim and criminalizing the actual criminal. But I think the social media piece, that's the hard part. And we kind of talked earlier, like, the instinct people have to trivialize, whether it's a podcast or an influencer, any sort of new industry that requires a level of self-promotion, that when you're not a normal public figure or celebrity, it seems self-indulgent to people on the outside, mm-hmm. despite being a very legitimate career option that the person has the right to do. And there's a lack of respect there. And I think especially in the MLM space, people are just so frustrated with the salespeople, with the tactics, with the people reaching out to them when they're postpartum, being like, you can get back to, you know, your old self. And you're like, F you. Why would you message me that? And I think there's so much like dialogue surrounding MLMs, too. It's kind of an interesting timing of like,
yes,
all of this, you know, kind of culminating with this story, because yes, that is insufferable behavior by and large, but again, irrelevant to the story, but it kind of just adds to the argument that people love that you said earlier, which is people want you to be living a lie. They want to be like, oh, I knew this wasn't real. I knew this was a highlight reel. And this is an example of that.
The last part is, the director does not believe that the mistress was involved at all, that she was bamboozled. She has apparently, from other reports, been put into some program where she can live under another name. No one really knows where she is. There was a sequence of events that seem fairly confusing. I wondered what your take was, because again, this is another instance where a woman meets a man, she's the mistress. Are we being too harsh on a woman that may have started a relationship, told by him that he was getting a separation and found out just before his wife was murdered that he had, in fact, no plans to leave? Or what other people say, that she was part of the process of convincing him that this was a reasonable way to clean slate?
That's such a difficult thing to pass adequate judgment on. And I feel this way anytime I hear about an affair situation, because, well, there should be accountability to a degree. It's just so hard for me to believe anybody would be like egging somebody on to kill their wife and children. Like, it just doesn't, you hope it's the exception, not the rule. You hope it's some deep, dark thing that like nobody would ever admit to somebody out loud or whatever. And I can't imagine that happening. All that to say, it's like, I don't know. I can't imagine this crime in and of itself happening right. either. Yeah. So I shouldn't put it past anybody. I guess I always really judged the mistress because of the, and I don't know if this is true or not, but didn't she Google how much money Scott Peterson's mistress got from her book deal?
Yeah, a number of things. She had said to investigators that she didn't really know that she wasn't really aware too much of his wife and what was going on in their life. I assure you, as a woman, you are a woman. When women get in relationships, they Google the shit out of people. She undoubtedly, well, there's a footprint where we knew that she was looking at his social media and her social media, but she makes it seem like she never looked. We know that that's not true. And I bet you she was saying to friends, you know, look up this woman's Instagram or Facebook, see what she's posting. This is the guy I'm dating. Does this look like he's leaving his wife? He says, I think she was maybe delusional, like in hoping that he really was being honest. But, you know, there's reason to believe that there's reason to believe. You know what I mean?
No, you're so right. I mean, when I met my husband, I did the deepest scroll. Right. I went back to like 06.
Exactly. Exactly. And then there was a Google search of his address. So she was like looking, she looked up the name of his mother. I mean, she was doing quite a bit of work. And I bet she was seething in anger. And he did say in some of the tapes with the investigators when they went to visit him in a prison that she was becoming more and more agitated by the calls that he would have to take from his wife, and especially in regards to the children. And she was beginning to realize once she was back in town that she would always be second fiddle to his family, like that he has these other children. When the wife was in North Carolina, he had all the time in the world to spend with her, and that dynamic would have changed. So I don't know that she's necessarily as honest as she makes herself out to be. There's reason to believe that she is not totally honest. And that's probably why she's in hiding, because people are going to ask her questions. And I think that there's reason to, you know, there is reason to ask her, because it doesn't seem totally like we're getting the full story.
Well, yeah. And I feel like a lot of it too, or at least my assumption is like, he really didn't want the mistress to find out she was pregnant again, because then she would know they were sleeping together. And I'm going to guess he said they weren't.
Totally. Exactly. But I just love hearing your insight. And I'm so sorry that I roped you into watching a true crime. But it sounds like it was worth it. Now, if I had said to you, it's an 8-part series, each episode is 2 hours, maybe you would have been more annoyed.
Yeah, I think that, I don't like to see evidence. I don't like gore. You know what I mean? I think that's kind of where one of the places where I draw the line. But like I said, this was so engaging because it wasn't through that creepy investigative lens. If anything, it was almost like creepy in a meta way, watching, you know, him fiddle around his house on the body cam and like try to lie, watching her on talk about how her perfect family, you know, and I know you covered the social dilemma lately. It all ties back. Like these themes are, this is what's popular right now, is like, everything's not as it seems. Yeah. It's not the most extreme examples. It's the next door examples. Mm-hmm. I thought this was a really interesting collective of popular themes right now. And I'm grateful you told me to watch it.
So tell everybody where they can catch your show and where they can follow you.
My show is called Be There in 5, iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, all that. Instagram is at Be There in 5, FIVE, not the number 5. And that's pretty much it. Comes out every week on Thursday.
Thank you a million times.
Thank you for having me.
The amazing Kate Casey.
I want to thank my great guests, Jenny Popwell and Kate Kennedy, and remind you all to subscribe to the show, to leave a 5-star review on iTunes, to join the Facebook group, Reality Life with Kate Casey. You can follow me on Twitter at Kate Casey. You can follow me on Instagram at Kate Casey CA. I will tell you the guests that I have coming up. I will tell you what I'm watching each week. Every Tuesday, I put out a list on social media telling you what shows to watch. So make sure you look out for that. And if you want bonus episodes, you can find me on Patreon, patreon.com/KateCasey. I'm wishing you all a great, great week, and I'm so excited for you to listen to Friday's episode.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.